All right, well, good morning again. We are coming to the conclusion of this long series on finances and money. And thank you all who have stuck with it for this long. I thought that after a couple of months of this, you would all find the Old Testament much more exciting than than this money class. So today, we want to talk about several items, and really they all come under the idea of planning. And we will be wrapping up a couple of topics from last week about purchase of long-term care insurance and prepayment of funeral expenses. And then we want to talk about household budgeting, and you say, well, how does all that work together? Well, really, they're all sort of planning. And the Bible does tell us to plan. There are many places in the Bible that talk to us about wise people plan. Part of living a wise life is planning. But here's the thing that we get messed up in our heads. Trust in God is always to be preeminent over planning. And at the beginning of this course, we looked at Proverbs chapter 3. And Proverbs chapter 3 has an awful lot to say about money, one of the most concentrated chapters in the Bible about money. And Proverbs 3 verses 5 and 6 are ones you may have you memorized and known. And it helps to get this relationship between trust and planning straight. And it's good to have those verses in your head. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. Now, what that tells me is that when we have trust in God in the right place in our life, He actually helps us with the planning. Trust in God with all your heart, and He will direct your paths. Okay? When God's on the throne, it's easy to have trust in front of planning. But oftentimes we reverse this in our lives. We put ourselves on the throne, and we put planning over trust. And we cherish and hold on to and grip to planning as a way to try to survive the uncertainty of the days ahead. We have it exactly opposite. So then we're no longer operating under Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. And so then, I don't think we have the same kind of direction and help in planning as we do when we have this right, when we have ourselves on the throne. And you know what one indication of this is? When we have ourselves on the throne and we're trusting in planning rather than trusting in God and we get this reversed, one of the outcomes of this in our life is this. Okay? When we have this reversed, we're more have a tendency to worry. And, of course, this is a trap that Satan uses to distract us even further from trust. It's trust and worry are not the same, are not different sides of the same coin. Worry tries to push trust away. Trust and worry are like oil and water. Okay? The more you worry, the harder it is to have trust. And the more you trust and have the relationship between trust and planning in the right perspective, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, the more you have this in the right perspective in your life, the more you'll be able to combat this sin of worry, which tends to paralyze all of us at times and grip all of us. Okay? So with that kind of introduction about planning and trust, let's talk practically about a few of these things that people, that you have asked me to cover in the class here. as we try to wrap up in these last week or two. Next week, we'll be talking a little bit about business and starting your own business and having multiple streams of income and that whole concept. And then in 2 weeks, the last Sunday of this class, we'll have another elder panel, as we did before. And I'll have some questions prepared for them, and then you'll have the opportunity to ask them questions, and we'll deal specifically with the topics that we have dealt with since the last elder panel, which are things like debt, saving and investing, views of retirement, and businesses. So look forward to that at the end of the month. And then new Sunday school classes start the beginning of March, and the sign-up sheets are out on the bulletin board, or if you want to be techie, which makes Steve Hines very happy, you can sign up on the website, and that really makes his day. So if you want to do something for a brother in the Lord this afternoon, get on the church website and sign up for Sunday school. That'll just make him happy. All right. Okay, so first item, prepayment of funeral expenses. Okay, there have been in the past funeral people have offered pre-planning where you can go and you can plan what kind of flowers you have at your funeral. Now, that's not something that excites me, but I guess for some people it does. You can decide whether you're going to be cremated or buried in a casket or any of that kind of stuff. And so you can have all of that done for your family. But then you can take the next step and you can actually pay for this ahead of time. And so the, as in all things, there are positives and negatives to this. The idea of paying ahead of time is supposedly that you save that burden on family members. It's all taken care of. That's how it's sold to you or promoted to you to do. And there, each state has different laws that regulate the whole kind of funeral industry, and there are not national laws on this, so each state is different, and each state has different laws regarding this whole process of prepayment. But the majority of the time, when you prepay, you guarantee the cost of what the funeral director has control of. But you don't guarantee the cost of other third-party contributors to the funeral. So when you go and prepay today, the funeral director might say, okay, if you want this kind of flower arrangement on top of your casket, it will cost you $200. The problem is that if you live for another 12 years, by the time you die and the funeral is held, that same spray of flower arrangement might cost $300. And the funeral director does not absorb that cost. The funeral director is supposed to take the money you pay today and invest it. And then that in whatever money he earns off of the investment is supposed to absorb the cost of inflating prices. Well, they will absorb the cost of what they do. You know, if you want to have a regular funeral of preparing the body and all that, they absorb the increased cost of that. But everything that third parties provide, they often do not. For instance, recently the Patriot News decided that obituaries are advertisements. All obituaries are advertisements, and so the price of obituaries to be printed in the Patriot News went up fourfold. Okay? It's now a serious deal to have your obituary printed in the Patriot News. And as a result, you know, if you prepaid back when it was $30 to put it in, whatever, I don't know what it was, but you know, now it's much higher. So things like flowers, printing of obituaries in the papers, if the church charges a fee, if pastor charges a fee, if the cost of the death certificates that you have to get from the state, the cost of grave excavation, there's all of these things that funeral directors contract with third parties to do at the time of a death. And all of the inflation and all of those things are not necessarily covered under prepayment agreements. So you just have to be aware of that so that you don't think if you go do this that everything's taken care of and there'll be no cost. Okay? Not a big deal. Questions on that before we move on to the next item? I know, not something you want to talk about all the time. Okay, long-term care insurance. Another issue that faces people. Anybody in here have a long-term care policy or have priced long-term care policies? Anybody? You have a long-term care policy for mom, okay? All right. And what age was she when you took that out? That doesn't tell me how old. How? Okay. And she's how old now? Okay. So you bought it when she was in her 60s or early 60s. Yeah. Yep. Okay. All right. And so does it cover the entire price of the long of the? Okay. All right. So there, Betsy just saved you 15 minutes because she just told you everything about long-term care that you need to know. Long-term care policies do not cover the whole expense. When we buy car insurance or when we buy homeowners insurance, if we have an accident or if our house burns down, we assume that other than a small deductible, the insurance usually pays for the replacement of that product. But when we buy long-term care insurance, usually it only covers a portion of what the long-term care facility actually charges. Now remember, and long-term care or assisted nursing care, these kinds of facilities, the price of these things take our breath away like college tuition does. The amount of money we talk about is just out of sight. So, a couple of years ago, when my father was in a nursing home in Carlisle, he was charged $300 a day for skilled nursing care. And that did not count, medicine or medical supplies or things like adult diapers or anything else, lotions, anything used on him. This was simply the price per day. So when we were talking about college tuition, I said about how hard it is to write a check for $10,000 or $15,000 twice a year for tuition for kids. It's really hard to write a check for a little over $10,000 a month for care like that. So, you know, my father was in this nursing home in Carlisle for 3 years, and so in those 3 years, he used about $330,000 to pay for his care. So what does, and the thing is that once you have no assets, then the federal and state programs come in to help pay for that. But like this, like healthcare, a healthcare company forces a doctor to accept a certain amount for every office visit. Well, these same government, different government programs, but it works the same way. They force the nursing homes to accept a much lower payment per day. So at that time, the payment from the government per day for someone who was there and using government assistance was $110 a day. Okay, so you can understand why nursing homes love to have beds filled with people who are paying on their own. Okay, and in reality, this cost is so high because the people who are paying on their own are actually helping to subsidize some of this. And you have to, in order to be on this, you have to spend your estate down until, I think right now, currently, it's $2,000. They let you have $2,000, which, of course, isn't even enough to have a funeral before you can get this rate. Now, when you first go in a nursing home, you know, you have 100 days that the government pays for you. And they're assuming potentially that you would get some therapy and some help, and maybe you can go home then. So when you first go in, you get 100 days paid for. But then after that, you either pay it on your own until you only have $2,000 left. So those are the rules of the game now. So that's why long-term care insurance is something that people are interested in. However, at the time when my father was paying $300 a day, and that was the going rate. It wasn't like he was in some Taj Mahal over there. The policies that he had looked into when he was in his early 60s, before there was any issues with his health, would pay about a third of this. So you heard Betsy say that with pension and Social Security, her bill is paid for. You cannot buy long-term care insurance that pays the entire bill. And you also heard her say that it was $4,000 a year for the premium. So the premiums on long-term care insurance, if you haven't looked into them, are astronomical compared to the premiums for what we normally think of as car insurance or home insurance, unless you have three boys all at the same time as teenagers who are driving. Then for a few years, your car insurance premiums approach the premiums of long-term care insurance. Okay, so anything you read about long-term care insurance will say, as they say about everything, start early. So, you know, they want you in your 30s to start paying long-term care insurance. Then the premiums are supposedly manageable. But who in their 30s, when you're trying to save for your kids' college and pay your mortgage and raise your kids and all this, is going to have money to pay? So, in reality, there's quite a bit of advice out there that says you really should just try to self-insure as best you can. A little over a quarter of Americans right now die in nursing homes. Even with all of the hospice care we have and so on, about a quarter die in nursing homes. The median stay in a nursing home is about 6 months. But the average stay is closer to 2.5 years. Now what that means is that most people go in and stay no longer than 6 months. In other words, they enter a nursing home right at the very end of life when it becomes impossible to care for them any longer at home. And they are really only there a short time. So, you know, at $10,000 a month, most people are there 6 months or less. that would be the bill. But you have some people, especially those who have some form of dementia or Parkinson's, like my father had, okay, who need skilled nursing care for a very long time because they have issues mentally and so on, but aren't necessarily dying from some other physiological reason. And those people are often in nursing home for years and years, like my father. So those people, that minority of people, actually bump the average stay up, if that makes sense to you. So should you buy long-term care insurance? It's not, it never was a very good deal. And as you just heard Betsy say, the policies are less attractive than what they were, because when they started offering this long-term care back in the 90s, by now what the companies realize is, hey, this isn't working out. We're paying out more money than we should. And so now the policies they're offering are more restrictive and have more cost to them than what they did even in the 90s. And I remember talking to my father about it, and I never thought it was a very good deal back in the 90s. But depending on, you know, what kind of challenges are in store for us, this can be a very serious issue with families and with estates and so on. Any questions on this? Yes. Well, what you're saying is that I think that if you know you're going into a nursing home and you try to give your money away, gift it to your children or something, they will come and assess you for this cost, because they will assume that in the old days, 20 years ago, you knew that you were facing this decision of going to a nursing home, and you could gift money to your children or somehow transfer assets. And then you only had the $2,000, and you walk in and you say, hey, I'm penniless, and they'd put you on Medicaid, and they'd pay for this. But now they look back a certain number of years, and those number of years has been increasing, the look back, at which they will assess children or anyone else who has received assets from your estate, from your future estate. And ask them to pay your bills for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yes, David. Yeah, as long as those assets are jointly owned, yes. Mm-hmm. That's part of that for better or for worse clause. And no young person who goes to the older ever envisions that's what for better or for worse means, you know. So, yeah, right. Yeah. Yep. So, you know, here's the bottom line about long-term care insurance. This is what a lot of people will say. The problem with long-term care insurance is that anybody who can afford it doesn't really need it. And those who need it can't afford it. Now, there's some truth to that. I mean, so I'm not trying to discourage you from looking at this. It's an option that's out there. It's a tool that might be right for you and your family. It's just nothing is ever a panacea, and this certainly is not. So, yep. but that, you know, Betsy's mom, it's an example of where it's working in their family. So, yeah. Right. Did you get that? Okay, so what she's saying is that if you have a net worth of between $100,000 and $300,000, okay, you should consider buying long-term care insurance. Because if you have less than $100,000 net worth, this will be used up so quickly anyhow that there's not much sense in having the policy. If you have more than $300,000, you probably don't need it because you remember I said how long the average stay is in a nursing home? If you have more than $300,000, you can be what they call self-insured. That if you have more than $300,000 in what will be your estate or your net worth, you can handle the cost, and there still will be some money left in your estate. So that's what Betsy's talking about. Yep. Okay? All right. If you have further questions, talk to Betsy, not me. Okay, she's got experience with it. Good. Okay, so what I handed out to you is something that normally is talked about on the first day of a Christian financial Sunday school class, which is budgeting and net worth. Now, businesses always use two, business people who own businesses are always looking at two things. One is their net worth statement, and the other one is what they call a profit and loss statement. Or P&L, this is often called, okay? And these two statements really drive the heart of most businesses from a financial point of view. How much am I actually worth? And am I worth more this year than last year? I worked all year at my business. Did I actually get ahead? Did I make any progress? You know, this is what a net worth statement is. And a profit and loss statement is, you know, how am I doing this month? Did my income actually exceed my bills? Or have I bought all kinds of parts to stock my trucks for my business, and therefore I have all kinds of money in inventory and money's tied up, and you know, I'm not, and so my bills were a lot this month. You know, this is what a profit and loss kind of thing are. So you can actually relate this to your family and use your family's financial situation and look at it kind of as a business. Certainly you can do the net worth where you have an accounting of all of your things you own and all the things you owe for and debts and see whether you actually have any net worth. And then you can do a monthly profit and loss statement, okay, which talks about how much money you have coming in, your salary or wherever else you get income from, and how much your expenses are. And this really gets to the budgeting thing that people talk about in families. Now, one of the first lessons of this class, back in the beginning of October, we were talking about children and teaching them about money. And I told you that in my world, even though God creates everybody as a unique individual, I have to be more simplistic in my view of the world, and I lump people into four buckets based on personality. Do you remember what those personalities were? A buffalo, a beaver. Boy, I am so impressed. That's been like 3 or 4 months ago. Whew. An otter. Oh, my. You guys are just making my day. A perfectionist, yes. And a golden retriever. Okay? Somebody who just loves on everybody. All right? Okay, so, and I said, you know, that this is not really totally accurate, but it makes me sleep well at night that I can just pigeonhole everybody into one of these four categories, you know, okay? Well, and we talked about how teaching money to kids, you know, your approach has to be different based on these personality types of your kids. Well, when it comes to budgeting and handling money as an adult, you know, some of us have a lot more challenge based on our personality. Now, someone who is a beaver and who loves detail, okay, budgeting is usually not an issue. They like that. I worked with a guy. This is a true story. I worked with a guy 25 years ago. He and his wife were not able to have children, and they had a sort of a very predictable, very contained kind of lifestyle. That was his personality. He was very much into details and having everything down. And he told me, this was, of course, way before computers and way before electronic banking, where you could get into your bank's website and check your balances every day, what transactions had occurred. This is when you waited for a monthly statement, you know. And this guy told me, he said, one of my favorite days of the year is when the bank statement comes. And I was looking at him like, okay. And he said, I'd love to open that. And he said, I sit down immediately as soon as supper's over and I look at my checkbook register. And he said, it always comes out to the penny. He said, that is the sweetest feeling. And I was like, okay, I don't think I'm going to be your friend, you know, but I'm dead serious. That's exactly what he said. Man, he was a super beaver, all right? Totally into detail. You know, he loved that. Okay. So for him, this kind of like budgeting exercise, beautiful. How easy is it for an otter to do budgeting? I don't have time, man. Even playing a board game is better than, doing a budget, okay? And how about a golden retriever? There's just so many people to love and so many needs that I need to talk to people about. There's no time to do a budget, you know, okay? And the buffalo, don't bother me with those details. I got goals to accomplish. You know, so for the majority of people, budgeting is just, it just doesn't come natural, okay? And yet, the first thing, the minute you pick up any kind of literature, look at any kind of website on trying to get control of your finances and maintain it, what's the first thing they tell you to do? Make a budget, yeah. Okay. Well, the reason they're saying make a budget is because it doesn't come natural to at least 3/4 of us. Okay. Only to those of you in the room who are blessed with this detail stuff does it come natural to make a budget, right? And I know that those of you who are beavers in the room look down on all the rest of us because, you know, we just don't like making a budget. But it is important to do so, and, of course, whether you're teaching your kids or whether you're trying to get control of your own finances, part of making a budget is understanding exactly where your money goes. And for many of us, we do not do that discipline. And even when we agree as couples to do that discipline, we're sometimes are very dishonest with each other about where the money goes. You know, it's easy to stop at Turkey Hill to fill up the gas tank and to buy coffee and to buy a pizza and to buy a bag of chips. And the whole bill's $27, so you come home and you tell your wife, Hey, I spent $27 on gas. Well, no, you only spent $20 on gas and you spent $7 on snacks, okay? So You know, there's a sense of calling to account and being honest when you're really looking for where you're spending your money. And so as a couple, if you're having issues with this and you need to work on budgeting and so on, one of the first things you have to agree upon is a sense of honesty with each other. Okay. And one of the reasons we're kind of dishonest about where our money goes is because we don't want this to really impact, you know, our little deal, whatever we like in life. Right. And so it's very important that honesty between a couple is primary as you begin this process. You can find all kinds of forms on the web about this. You can find forms on the web which give recommended percentages of how much of your money should go to certain categories in budgeting. What I handed out to you is just copied out of Crown Financial Ministries books. We have some of that information in the library if you want to get serious about this and are interested in closer look at this process. In a group this size, you're at all at different spots, so I'm not planning to go through this in detail. Any questions on this? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was. But then in a meeting this week, I got chastised for not getting Sunday school over with quick enough, so I was going to get it over with here sooner. But I'll answer this question. And since an elder asked this question, if we don't get out of class soon enough, it's not my fault. You know, how's that for passing the blame? Yeah, you know, some people say if you are meeting your tithing goals, assuming that it's not that your tithing goals are not 1%. If you are honest before the Lord and being challenged in giving, if you are meeting your tithing goals and you are meeting your savings goals, whatever they are, and you're paying off your debts appropriately within 30 days as they come due, there's no need for a budget. Okay? If you're meeting your tithing goals, you're meeting your saving goals, and you're paying off your debts as you should be, there's no need for a budget. Now, I know that's heresy to the financial people who say that everybody should have a budget. But the thing is, I like that because I'm not a beaver. But it does come with strings attached. Are you meeting your tithing goals? Are you meeting your savings goals? Are you paying your debts on time? If you're doing those three things, why do you need a budget? So that's what I was going to talk about. Does it make sense? Yeah, it does. So there's nothing magical about a budget except to help you if you come to the end of the month and you're not able to tithe. And really, that's a trust issue. And if you're maintaining balances on your credit card and you're unable to pay those off month to month, and if you're not meeting any savings goals, whether that's to put money aside for kids in college or whatever, if you're not able to do those things, then do a budget. Find out where your money's going. Figure out how to partition your money differently so that you can meet those goals. If you're meeting those goals, don't do a budget. Any other questions? Okay, next week we'll talk a little bit about business, starting small business, having multiple income streams. And in 2 weeks we'll have an elder panel. Thank you for coming to Sunday school. Let's close in prayer. Father, we do need your guidance in planning, knowing that for each of us, you hold a different path that is perfect in your wisdom to mature us as you want us to be. And so, Father, help us in our lives to have trust in you as our preeminent focus of life. And that in all the planning we do, it would be subservient and in recognition of your authority over our lives. We do trust in you, Father, and thank you for all of your past goodness to us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. See you next week.